This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events.
One of the definitions of NGOs is that they cope with the failures of governments, where government services are no longer available for one reason or another, because the state has ceased to exist in some countries, because the state is unable or is under-resourced to provide services. But NGOs are also coping with the failures of market institutions.
The explosion of citizen-based, non-governmental organizations on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. You've heard of them: Amnesty International, Oxfam, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the Environmental Defense Fund. In official circles, these mostly volunteer, grassroots organizations are called either NGOs or PVOs, which stand for non-governmental or private voluntary organizations. They play an important role in international affairs, filling in where they perceive a need, and sometimes lobbying for changes in policies. My three guests today have all worked for NGOs and studied how they could be even more effectively integrated into the international system. First, we hear from Frank Judd, currently a member of the British House of Lords and former director of Oxfam UK.
The important point to get across is that there is a tremendous diversity. It stretches from big organizations representing employers, or the big organizations representing workers in trade unions and so on, to very small voluntary organizations dealing perhaps with the needs of children or with the needs of health. And in between, a great range. And now, of course, with many thousands of such organizations, they exist in all parts of the world. And one of the things that I think is most exciting is the way in which they are rapidly developing in Africa, in Asia, in the Middle East, in the Pacific Rim, in South Africa as it comes up to its first full democratic elections. The NGOs are playing a very dynamic part. Latin America, Central America, they're there. And this represents a great number of people who care passionately about issues, trying to do something about them.
Next is Jessica Tuckman Matthews, who helped found the World Resources Institute, a think tank on environmental and natural resource management policy. She's currently a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, I just pick up on that. I was spent a few weeks in Southeast Asia this spring, and I was everywhere I went, I heard the same refrain that there had been an explosion in the number and the vitality of NGOs in the last 3 years, over and over again. And I remember one former Indonesian general telling me he'd just come back from a meeting in Vietnam that was supposed to be talking about regional security arrangements, and the first thing the Vietnamese had asked him was, what was Indonesia's government rules regulating NGOs? He was just flabbergasted by it, and still was when he told me the story. I think nobody quite can explain why this has happened. Clearly, the telecommunications revolution is part of it. The end of the Cold War is part of it, because it's kind of freed voices that would otherwise have been silenced, I think. CNN and the global media is part of it. But I don't think any of that fully explains why this sudden burst that is so dramatic.
Jessica, don't you think it's partly because there's a tremendous frustration about formal politics, and that the formal political systems are not delivering, and that therefore a lot of highly intelligent young people, not always young people, but frequently young people, real dedication, say we want to get directly involved in doing something about specific issues on which we can have an impact. Now, of course, there's an argument about how many people these organizations represent, and that's an important consideration. But what they represent in terms of the commitment of the people involved is very exciting, and for myself, I think it's a guarantee of the future health of the human species, because here are people saying, we don't have to give up, we're not all helpless, it's not true that we can't influence events. If we really get down to it and really take on a commitment in a specific sphere, we can have an impact.
I think, I assume that that's, again, part of it, but I talked to somebody, an American who'd been working in Thailand for 30 years, and I asked him what was the biggest change he'd seen in the country in that period, one of those sort of unanswerable, silly questions. But right away he came back and he said, the explosion of village-based NGOs in Thailand in the last 3 years, and groups that started working on water issues, on soil erosion issues, quickly got to land tenure issues, from there got to the whole question of authority and started questioning the kind of top-down governance structure in the village. I said, well, why the last 3 years? He said, I don't know. I mean, this is not television there. The village is without electricity. The frustration presumably has been there for a long time. Why there's been this coming together right now, I don't know, but it seems to be real.
Our third guest is Thierry Lemarsquier, who has spent many years working with NGOs on non-formal education in Africa and the Middle East. Now he's managing the NGO program for the United Nations Development Program.
Well, I think one of the reasons that we haven't mentioned yet is that people get involved in areas where other structures have failed. Frank was talking about the frustration with traditional political models. But there is the clear failure of institutions that were supposed or are still supposed to provide services that people need. And one of the definitions of NGOs is that they cope with the failures of governments, where government services are no longer available for one reason or another, because the state has ceased to exist in some countries, because the state is unable or is under-resourced to provide services. But NGOs are also coping with the failures of market institutions, particularly in areas where services are being provided at a cost which no one can afford. So non-governmental organizations are partly, the growth of those organizations is partly explained by the need to step in, which raises all kinds of very interesting issues, because at the end of the day, governments or states are being moved out of areas where it was thought until very recently that their role was very legitimate. And NGOs are being thrown into programs and operations on a scale with which they were not meant to cope until very recently. And everybody's finding themselves having to redefine their role and their relationship. And this is probably why this issue of NGOs is looming so high on everybody's agenda today.
And in addition to possibly filling in gaps where the governments have failed or fallen short, aren't NGOs also leading movements or identifying issues out there that haven't even...
I'm absolutely certain that one of the most important forms of service for those in need, for the disadvantaged, one of the most important forms of service that can be provided by NGOs is advocacy.
Again, this is Frank Judd, the former director of Oxfam UK.
I think that if we regard NGOs as being about solidarity, which is what I think they're about, identifying with people, not patronizing people with needs, but identifying with people with needs, part of this is working beside them, ensuring a fairer distribution of resources so that they get some of what's going, so that they can make a success of what they want to do, building their own school, starting their own clinic, improving their agriculture, putting in a water supply or whatever. But it's also knowing that in places that matter, there are people who are going to speak for them and articulate their case and represent them. Now, I think that's only an interim phase, because I'm quite sure that very fast they're going to do that for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Part of what's changed, perhaps, is that during the Cold War, international relations were managing the Cold War and the specter of a nuclear catastrophe was so much the dominant issue And even for the non-nuclear states, it was aligning yourself somewhere along the U.S.-Soviet axis, and that was the role you played in the place you occupied. And now, and citizens, individual citizens, had very little role to play. In that whole 45 years, really, I think the only time public opinion played a key role was in the debate over the test ban treaty, the atmospheric test ban in the early 60s, when people really got engaged. And maybe in the U.S., a brief moment around the nuclear freeze movement. But by and large, individual behavior and in people's individual feelings, really, or concerns, played almost an invisibly small role. Now, with that issue gone, issues much closer to people's everyday lives are rising on the international agenda, even in some places coming to dominate it. I mean, jobs and economic competitiveness, but also pollution and poverty and drugs and health and ill health and the whole spectrum of issues in which people feel much closer, people have a much greater knowledge of what the problems are and also what the solutions are. And the solutions rest not just on the determination of a few hundred thousand or a thousand people in governments, but on the behavior of billions of people. You know, I mean, really, that's where both the problems and the solutions lie. So there's a natural shift in sort of the center of gravity, I think, of the international system.
Thierry Lemarre-Esquier.
I think the advocacy function is admirably seen on the level of the UN. I mean, if you look at the number of policy areas in which the governments have had to get themselves involved, if you look at the record in the field of human rights, if you look at what happened with the preparation of the Earth Summit in 1992 in Rio, if you look at a whole range of other areas, you might say that the agenda of the United Nations is increasingly being influenced by NGOs that are bringing to the international level both the problems experienced by the constituencies with which they work and the solutions that they are finding to address these issues. And I think what's interesting right now is that basically you can't envisage a single event or process in the UN that would engage meaningfully the community of governments if it wasn't at least helped, pushed is a better word probably, by a very wide range of organizations who are going to probably be the only thing that can bring sufficient pressure to bear on governments in order for their commitments to be serious. So I think we've reached a situation where in many important areas, I think the environment is one, but I can think of many others, the whole issue of consumer protection internationally was brought by NGOs, by no one else, where it is in fact the UN that needs the NGOs rather than the other way around.
Listening to Common Ground, a service of the Stanley Foundation. We are talking about the role of non-governmental organizations in the international system. My guests are Thierry Lemarre-Esquier, manager of the NGO program at the United Nations Development Program, Jessica Tuckman-Matthews, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Frank Judd, a member of the British House of Lords and former director of Oxfam UK. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Please listen at the end of this broadcast for details. At times, non-governmental organizations will campaign for specific government policies, but Frank Judd feels it should not be their primary purpose.
It's absolutely essential that the NGOs remain committed to their practical work because that is what gives them the authority with which to speak out. I've spent exactly half my life in NGOs and half my life in conventional politics. And for some of the time that I was in conventional politics, I've been what we call in Europe a minister, part of the administration. Now, when people came to see me as a minister, if people had a good intellectual case that they were putting, of course one would listen. But if people came and spoke with the authority of engagement, of actually being practitioners in the middle of a situation, people who were experiencing what they were talking about, that put them into a completely different category. And I think that the strength, the very special strength of the NGO's contribution to political life in the widest sense of that word, not party political life, but political life, is that they speak with the authority of being practitioners. It's when people say, you know, so-and-so is doing, that organization is doing this, that, and the other. If you heard what they're saying, that's strong. If it ever got to the point at which people were saying, oh, God, that organization's saying this week, and it's saying that way. What do they do? They'd have lost their position. They must be seen first as doers, and then people listen to them when they speak out.
Well, I guess the group that I spent 11 years with was not really a doer. What we do is policy research. But there can be times when that impact is enormously direct. I mean, I can think, for example, one of our staff people, along with a Brazilian collaborator, did a study at one point where they were looking at the cause of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. And they were able to show in an enormously convincing way that these developments were happening because of Brazilian tax breaks, which made activities that would otherwise be money losers into profitable enterprises. And this study showed in a dramatic way that this policy was both costing the Brazilian government a ton of money through the tax break, as well as leading to really the most severe environmental degradation and criticism that they were getting internationally as well. And 4 months after the study came out, the tax breaks were removed. So that you can do in different ways. You can do on the ground. You can do marches. You can do with, as some groups do, by getting out there in rafts and blocking boats, or you can do with a piece of paper. There's a tremendous range of do. And the crucial thing, I think, is both the validity of performing a service and the quality of the ideas.
And I think one of the really most interesting changes that have taken place in the last few years is in the developing countries, where you see a number of organizations which were assumed until recently to be essentially involved in projects and nothing else, actually adopting a much more integrated action agenda and combining their operational work with communities with information and advocacy. And the reason they do it is very simple. I take an example from a country in Southeast Asia where a lot of consumer protection work has taken place in the last 20 years, Malaysia. The people who've been involved in developing the consumer protection movement in Malaysia were originally people doing village development schemes with small producers, farmers. And what happened to them was that they realized over a period of just a few years that what they were trying to build over a period of several years could be undone overnight by changes in international pricing of the commodities that were being sold by those producers. And they decided to look into issues like terms of trade and the various channels by which people's outputs are being sold and so on. And they started a totally different kind of movement, which is now providing, in fact, analysis and sensitive information to quite a large number of producers in that region. Now, that's interesting because that's grown out of a realization by third world practitioners themselves. And I think one of the really interesting phenomena now is that the policy advocacy function is being increasingly assumed by groups that are in and from the developing countries themselves.
Well, based on your different experiences, how do you feel governments and government agencies view NGOs? Do they want to work with them? Do they feel that NGOs get in the way?
Well, there's a tremendous range. And by and large, governments or perhaps I should only speak for the U.S. government, which is the only one I know at all intimately, particularly in the international area, tend to think that really the only thing that matters internationally is the memos that they write and the cables that they read from capital to capital, and that's what's setting the international agenda. And they tend to think that what goes on outside governments is of very, very minor importance. There are individual exceptions, of course, but that's usually the rule. It's changing, and it's less true in a domestic scene where people are sort of in a whole sea of NGOs, but there's a lot of resentment. This is, NGOs can make trouble for them and stuff. On the other hand, they're also starting to use NGOs and to rely on NGOs. For example, when governments want to be seen to be doing something but don't really want to do it themselves in a humanitarian or crisis sense, or when they don't want to be seen doing something and but yet they want it done, more and more they will turn to NGOs to try to deliver the services.
Now, Thierry Lemarescier, I assume since you work for the United Nations Development Program on their NGO program, your organization has a different view of NGOs.
Not a different view, but indeed the cooperation that we have with them is in fact almost exclusively in developing countries. And there the record is also very mixed. I think there's generally a much better acceptance, a much stronger recognition today by public authorities of the role that NGOs play in development, in the many different ways in which NGOs engage in development work. That said, there continues to be an element of reluctance, which of course is very strong in some countries and almost non-existent in others. There's a lot of the time you still feel, particularly in sort of middle level of government bureaucracies, a feeling that non-governmental actually means anti-governmental, and that these organizations are there on behalf of some form of influence from outside the country, which is potentially threatening to whatever the government thinks it needs to do. And I think, by and large, practice is changing that in almost every country of the world. But I think there still is a line being drawn somehow between the level of acceptance of NGOs in terms of what project and programs they have on the ground in the country and the sort of role that they play at the international level when they start getting involved in issues of observance of human rights and so on. So we're dealing with a changing reality, but some old problems continue to exist.
Well, we better be wrapping this up, but how important is it for NGOs and for governments to work together? Is it essential for both parties?
I think that it's more that there is a natural tension, and there needs to be, there must be. I mean, that's kind of an integral to what NGOs are there for. They're there to push, to prod, to bring new ideas, to force honesty when governments can't or won't say it. So I think the relationship is never meant to be cozy. It should be constructive. But it will never be a comfortable one, I think.
Frank Judd, did you
I think there should be an active dialogue, and I think it should be an uncomfortable, creative but uncomfortable relationship. What I detect as a danger is that governments, and perhaps international organizations too, getting a bit irritated by the pressure which NGOs are bringing to bear, will now have a campaign to co-opt them, and will sort of seduce them by subcontracting them, using them as cheap providers of service, so that the organizations become dependent on official funds, and the sort of tacit understanding, or perhaps the explicit understanding, will be that they're to shut up if they're to get the funds, and they will begin to become less outspoken about the issues, and that would be unfortunate. So I think there's a tremendous need for the NGOs to retain their independence. When I was director of Oxfam UK, which was, as I say, one of the larger NGOs in Europe, my trustees had an absolute firm rule that we would not take more than 10% of our funds from government and more than 20% from official sources altogether, because they were afraid that we would begin to lose our independence and our objectivity if that happened. Now, I used to think sometimes chief executive, they set the figure a bit low, but I think the spirit of what they were after was absolutely right. But may I make just one other point? I think the NGOs have also got a great challenge, because if they're going to sustain their pressure over a prolonged period of time, it's not just a matter of their speaking directly to governments and to international organizations. It's a matter of their persuading a cross-section of people in their society, their local chambers of commerce, their local Rotarians, their local women's organizations and so on, to share their concerns and speak out. Because if they can maximize the concern coming from different directions in society, that will sustain the pressure much more effectively.
Mr. Lemarescu, any final thoughts on this relationship between...
Well, I think what Frank is describing now is the responsibility that NGOs have towards this increasingly accepted concept of civil society, which is the whole range of organizations that spring out of social movements and which are going to be the domain within which the accountability of NGOs to constituencies is going to be guaranteed. And if the growth of that sector is going to continue and be sustained, that is what is going to prevent some of the co-optation that Frank says is looming as a major risk, which I think is very true. The fact is that there is today an increasing amount of money being funneled through the non-governmental channel, not least because so many of the other channels have failed. And I think it's very important to resist the temptation of equating developing civil society with just accepting money for projects.
Anyone have a wild guess on the number of NGOs out there?
In the Philippines alone, 36,000, and that's a conservative estimate.
You see, if you're really counting, as you must, everything from the very local level up to the International Red Cross, you are talking about a huge universe of activity.
Yes, and I mean, I think that many families in different parts of the world taking life into their own hands and doing something about it, in fact, become a family NGO, so it probably runs into millions.
But you see, I'd like to make a point here, because, in fact, it is one of the things that are constantly thrown at us working with NGOs. Say, there are so many of them, how can you work with them? You know, being described as an unruly bunch, essentially.
But come on, isn't that the excitement of humanity?
That is precisely the excitement. And if you look at the countries where democracy, how vaguely defined you want to have it, functions, it usually is because the number of NGOs, the ratio of NGOs per 1,000 inhabitants is very high.
You've been listening to Common Ground. My guests have been Thierry Lemarskier, manager of the Non-Governmental Organization Program at the United Nations Development Program, Jessica Tuckman Matthews, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a founder of the World Resources Institute, and Frank Judd, former director of Oxfam UK and a member of the British House of Lords. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. To order a printed transcript or audio cassette of this Common Ground program, contact Journal Graphics at 1-800-824-5746. Ask for program number 9414. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comments about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, to purchase transcripts or audio cassettes, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.